Hey guys, welcome to another episode of A Slut with Morals. I'm your host, Ruby May. You can follow me on any social media platform by putting in A Slut with Morals in your favorite search engine. Or you can click on the Linktree link in the description below and not only see every social media link, but if you are a veteran or just someone that wants or needs help, there are links there to help you as well, such as betterhelp.com. Those of you that believe in this podcast and by rating the podcast and word of mouth as well. So all of you that do that, thank you so much. Also, thank you so much for being patient with me on this episode. At first, my youngest got sick and then I did, and we already know that kids are fucking disease cesspools, right? Like, I mean, I'm still pretty sick, but here I am now. So if my voice is shaky or it sounds like, or I sound like Phoebe from Friends, just it's because I'm still sick. So, Rockaholics dropped its first episode on the history of rock, and I am so proud of the work Alec and I put into it. I could not ask for a better co-host with the same level of love of music that I have. The link will also be down in the description below. So, if you guys want to or listen to me and Alec goof off and be completely stupid and talk about rock and roll, which, if you guys don't know the history of rock and roll, that's probably the episode that you want to listen to. So this episode will definitely be a two-parter because it involves a few of my favorite things. These are a few of my favorite things: sex, drugs, chaos, murder. Wait, I don't love murder, okay? I love sex and I love true crime and I love chaos and no comment on the drugs. And sometimes these things just kind of tend to go hand in hand, right? So here's a little question for you guys. How do most of you start your mornings? I usually scream for about the first 5 minutes and then I wake up my oldest for school. Depending on how much time it takes to wake her up, because some mornings it's a fucking battle. Am I right? Like, it's sometimes, I don't know what it is with these preteens. Like, Jesus, depending on how much time it takes me to wake her up, I read news articles while drinking my Black Rifle light roast gunship brew coffee while she gets ready for school. And a few months ago, this headline that I read completely caught me by surprise. But first, this episode is sponsored by Podcastagram, the home of podcast promotion and podcast tips and tricks. I love this podcast page, and if you're trying to start a podcast or already have one that needs a small boost, go and follow Podcastagram on Instagram and talk to Pat, who will give you the warmest Irish welcome and bring your podcast to the next level. On his page, you'll have the pleasantry of talking to and meeting other podcasters and have the chance to be on other podcasts like I have. And every podcaster knows growth is growth. So back to the episode. The headline, I saw you ask. Spanish porn star charged with reckless homicide after toad venom death. I swear, headlines that involve porn stars are almost as loud as the titles on their videos when you're scrolling on porn sites. Can you imagine, you guys, can you imagine just for a moment if porn titles were read like headlines back in the day? Hear ye, Latina BBW seduces young stepson with chubby fat tits. Stepmom caught me jerking off and helped me come on her face. Deep throat slut with no limits, degraded and humiliated in all three fuckholes. Yes, these are all real titles. CNN News reported Spanish porn star Nacho Vidal was arrested on suspicion of manslaughter in May following an 11-month investigation, according to a statement at the time from Spain's law enforcement agency, the Guardia Civil. The investigation showed the victim, a photographer, died after participating in a spiritual or mystical ceremony in July 2019 in the town of Enjuera, near Valencia in eastern Spain, according to a statement from court in Xativa, a town in the province of Valencia. The ritual, which took place in Vidal's home, involved inhaling venomous vapors from the burning of scales from a Bufo Alvarez toad, according to the statement. And Vidal's lawyer at the time, Danielle Salvador, of the firm Vossler Lawyers, declined to comment on the case when contacted by CNN. Salvador then told CNN in June that the death was a tragic accident and that his client was not responsible. The court dismissed proceedings against a cousin of Vidal and another person investigated, saying that they had no criminal responsibility because they had no control of the situation and were not involved in directing the ceremony. Neither of their names has been made public, and police have not named the man who died. Also known as the Colorado River Toad or the Sonoran Desert Toad, the amphibian releases a venom called 5-MeO-DMT, which is known to have hallucinogenic effects. It is about 4 to 5 times more powerful than the better-known DMT, which stimulates the production of serotonin, a neurotransmitter that causes feelings of happiness, according to Addiction Center. And according to the court statement, Vidal was the director of the ritual and had experience in taking the drug in question. He allegedly supplied the drug and failed to control properly the amount the victim hailed. If found guilty, Vidal could face up to 4 years in prison, according to Section 142 of the Spanish Penal Code. Penal. At age 47, Vidal has appeared in at least 10,000 scenes in a porn career spanning 26 years, according to his website. So, this got me thinking of a little thing called the Wonderland Murders. Do y'all know about the Wonderland Murders? If not, stay tuned. If yes, stay tuned anyway, because not only am I going to go over other porn stars that have either been arrested for allegedly committing homicide or have died mysterious deaths. But Ruby, shouldn't this be an episode on Down the Rabbit Hole? I mean, probably, but Down the Rabbit Hole is currently concentrating on creepy urban legends in the States right now. So, the Wonderland Murders, or the Four on the Floor Murders, or the Laurel Canyon Murders. Okay, you got it. People, unfortunately, were murdered, right? You understand this. Before Ron Jeremy, before James Dean, there was John Holmes, or, as known in director Bob Chin's films, Johnny Wad, the first king of adult movies, the very first male porn superstar. His quote-unquote size became the thing, pun intended, of legends. His penis, when erect, according to said legend, measured between 11 and 15 inches in length and over 4 inches around. Oh yeah. And for sake of this podcast episode, I had to do a lot of research on Sir Wad. At the height of his career, our boy Johnny was making up to $3,000 per filming day. He was one of the most prolific male adult film actors in history, appearing in over 2,400 movies in the 1970s and 80s, and his legendary assets. Why, they inspired Mark Wahlberg's character in 1997's epic Boogie Nights. But for Holmes, the money and the fame didn't last forever. Holmes was born on August 8, 1944, a Leo, in Asheville, Ohio. In his early years, he went by John Curtis Estes. He was the youngest of the 4 children born to Mary June Holmes. The name of John's father, Estes, was not listed on his birth certificate. Mary and her new husband, Edward Holmes, father of Holmes' 3 older siblings, had a very troubling marriage. But Mary changed John's surname to Holmes when he was little. Later, around 1986, his mother finally provided him with the handwritten copy of his original birth certificate, and Holmes discovered the name of his biological father, Carl Estes. Holmes had a turbulent childhood. Between his religious zealot mother and his abusive alcoholic stepfather, eager to escape the chaos, Holmes left home as a teenager to enlist in the army. Holmes spent most of the 3 years of his military service in the Signal Corps in West Germany until he was honorably discharged. He moved to Los Angeles and took a string of jobs selling things door to door, operating a forklift, and working at a coffee nips factory. Nips. How foreshadowing. He then met a nurse named Sharon when he was working as an ambulance driver, and they married in 1965. But Ruby, if he was married,
how did he become a porn star?
Well, let's not be fucking judgmental pricks and forget that sex workers are people too. A lot of them are married, and a lot of them do have children. There are several stories about how exactly Holmes went from forklift operator slash ambulance driver to an adult star. One version is that in 1967, Holmes was going to a men's card playing club in Gardena when a photographer for an underground magazine saw his ridiculously large member while standing next to him at a urinal and gave Holmes his business card, telling him he could make money posing for magazines. So much for the keep your eyes to yourself rule, am I right? If only Letterkenny was around back in the day. Anyway, at the end of the day, he pretty much came home, told his wifey, hey, I'm gonna have sex with other people for money because I was told I should, and so I'm gonna. And his wife, who was a virgin when they married, was like, what the fuck? I suppose I'm okay with this, even though I'm not really okay with it because you're a whore. And then John did. Although becoming estranged later on, their marriage lasted a good while too. They were married in 1965 and divorced 18 years later in 1983. So almost 20 years, right? In 1976, at the age of 31, he met 15-year-old teenager Gianna, who became his girlfriend while he was married, nonetheless. But that's nothing new though, is it? A man in power with a big dick and money gets a young little thing on his arm. Man, if only having a big clit was something to brag about, women out here would be like, yeah, suck it. Suck that big clit. I don't know why I said it in that voice. I'm sorry. It was funnier in my head. Moving on, Holmes's career started to take off in the 1970s with an adult series about a private investigator named Johnny Wadd, written and directed by Bob Chin. The success of Johnny Wadd inspired, inspired Chin to follow that up the same year with Flesh of the Lotus. Most of the Johnny Wadd films were written and directed by Chin and Holmes. Well, our buddy had ignited an entire adult franchise. Holmes went on to make more than 2,000 movies. Teenage Cowgirls, Liquid Lips, China Cat, Tapestry of Passion, Eruption, a porn remake of Double Indemnity, Dick Man and Robin, a lampoon of Batman and Robin, Hard Candy, a 3D thriller, and a porn documentary of his life made in 1981 was called Exhausted. During this era, the wild success of films like Deep Throat and The Devil and Miss Jones made adult films cool, but it was still attacked and subjected to scrutiny. Imagine an adult film having critics. Oh, they're going for doggy style again, Chadwick. Can't they create a new position? A woman on top, but backwards. Exemplary. My, Chadwick, isn't this fascinating? It was during this era Homeboy kept getting arrested for pimping and pandering, but he avoided prison time by becoming an LAPD informant. Well, yeah, he became a snitch, and snitches get put in ditches, or something like that. But what was the beginning to our friend's end? Well, by the late 1970s, when Holmes was taking home around $3,000 per filming day, his drug habit was becoming a serious fucking problem. It made him impotent, which obviously affected his work, right? Because coke dick is real, you guys. He was freebasing one hit of coke every 10 or 15 minutes, swallowing 40 to 50 Valium a day just to cut the edge. The drugs affected his penis. He couldn't get it up. He couldn't work in porn. So, not being able to work in porn affected his finances. In order to support himself and his drug habit, not his girlfriend or his wife, by the way, but himself and his drug habit, Holmes started selling drugs, prostituting himself and committing credit card fraud and petty theft. His mistress, Gina, who'd been with him since she was 15, was turning tricks just to support his habit.
Wow.
That's true love, isn't it? They were living out of the trunk of his estranged wife's Chevy Malibu. Nice job there, Holmes. And I mean, Holmes was also stealing luggage off conveyor belts at LA International Airport, buying appliances with his wife's credit cards, fencing them for cash. But things only got worse for him. In the early 1980s, Holmes became close with drug dealer slash gangster and nightclub owner Eddie Nash. And unfortunately, Holmes by now was also associated with the Wonderland Gang, a group of heroin-addicted cocaine dealers. I mean, I'm sorry. At least they're not getting high on their own supply, right? Wrong. What a mouthful. Heroin-addicted cocaine dealers. Well, this beautiful gang of people lived in a row house located on Wonderland Avenue in Los Angeles. Holmes worked for the gang, often selling drugs for them, but he was in deep debt to the gang and to nightclub owner Eddie Nash. My, how the mighty fall. In June 1981, supposedly in exchange for his life, he told the Wonderland gang about a huge stash of drugs, money, and jewels that Nash had in his house after having visited Nash the night before, since Nash still loved Johnny as a friend, and Johnny could just go on over there and just chill and be like, hey, what's up, friend? And Nash would be like, hey, come on in, you want some crack? And Johnny would be like, no, but I'll take some blow, you know? I'm sorry. I'm just playing this in my head. But remember, unfortunately, Holmes was into Nash for a small fortune. But Holmes was also owed the Wonderland Gang, too. He'd messed up a delivery and had a big argument with the gang leaders, Deverell and Lanius. They took back his key to Wonderland, and Lanius punched him out, then hit Holmes with his own blackthorn walking stick. They told him to make good. He tried to think. Addled synopsis played him a picture. And one picture only. Eddie Nash. This is when Holmes allegedly helped arrange a robbery that would take place in the wee hours on June 29th, 1981. So close your eyes and let me set the scene. Unless you're driving, of course, keep your eyes on the road and just use your imagination with your eyes open. Or if you're sitting at your desk working, your cute doggo is staring out the window into the gray abyss. It's June 28th, 1981. It's a warm Sunday night. The drugs are gone. The money is gone. Your situation? Desperate. You're at 8763 Wonderland Avenue. Rent is only $750 a month. I know. It's a steal. Quit thinking about that. Yeah, roll your eyes at me again. I saw that too. I mean, I looked it up. In today's currency, that's equivalent to $2,300. Nod your head. It makes sense now. I know. Anyway, 8763 Wonderland Avenue. There's a garage on the first floor that has a stairway leading to the front door that's caged in iron. There's a telephone at the entrance, an electronic deadbolt on the gate, and two adorable little pit bulls sleeping on the front steps. The second and the third floors had balconies facing the street. But was the house as beautiful? Fuck no. The paint was cracked and chipped and rust was, you know, stained down from the gutters. It was a complete fucking eyesore compared to the rest of the trendy neighborhood. Retro is what we'd call it now, I believe. And at this moment, inside of 8763 Wonderland Avenue, were seven people. Five men and two women sitting in their swivel chairs or leaning against a wall around the breakfast nook, smoking a cigarette, shaking, withdrawing, jonesing, planning what we now know as their very last heist. Joy Audrey Miller, 46, held the lease. She was thin, blonde, foul-mouthed, and a heroin addict with seven arrests. She had two daughters and had once been married to a Beverly Hills attorney. A year ago, she'd been busted for dealing drugs out of the Wonderland house. And 6 months ago, she'd had a double mastectomy. Her lover, Billy Deverell, 42, was also a heroin addict. He had a slight build, a pockmarked face, and a record of 13 arrests. Good job, Audrey. Good job. We applaud. We applaud your taste in men. But misery loves its company, right? Because sharing the house with Miller and Deverell was Ronald Lannis, 37, blonde and bearded. Lannis had served federal time for drug smuggling. A California cop once called him one of the coldest people he had ever met. Miller, Deverell, and Lannis needed drugs every day. They were always looking for an opportunity. Jewelry stores, convenience stores, private homes. It doesn't matter. They would try anything, steal anything, as long as it meant money for drugs. They'd sold a pound of Colombian Bam Bam for $250,000. There were now prices to be paid for their lives, though. And, well, thanks to our buddy John Holmes, they had another idea. Before them were two pairs of handcuffs, a stolen police badge, several automatic pistols, and a dog-eared sheet of paper with something scribbled on it. A floor plan. The floor plan before them showed a three-bedroom, high-end tract house in a cul-de-sac in the San Fernando Valley. It had a pool and a sunken living room with a white stone facade. Inside was a painting by Rembrandt, a jade and ivory collection, sterling silver, jewelry, and most appealing of all, large quantities of both money and drugs. The man who owned the house was named Adel Nasrallah. He was known as Eddie Nash. A naturalized American, Nash came to California from Palestine in the early 50s. In 1960, he opened a hot dog stand on Hollywood Boulevard. By the mid-70s, Nash held 36 liquor licenses, owned real estate, and other assets worth $30 million. Nash was a drug dealer and a heavy user. His drug of choice was Freebase home-cooked crack cocaine, and he was smoking it at the rate of 2 to 3 ounces a day. Many of you may be wondering, well, what exactly is the difference between crack and cocaine? Literally nothing, except jail time. Thanks to Nixon and Reagan's stupid Fair Sentencing Act, while a person found with 5 grams of crack cocaine faced a 5-year mandatory minimum prison sentence, a person holding powder cocaine could receive the same sentence only if he or she held 500 grams. So it's the 1 to 100 grams rule here. If you're going to put anything in your pocket, make sure it's the powder, not the rock, okay? Not that I'm advising you or anything, but if you're gonna put something in your pocket or hold something for a friend, make sure it's powder and not the rock, okay? All right. So our buddy Nash, why, he always had large quantities of coke, heroin, quaaludes, no longer manufactured, and other drugs at home. His bodyguard, Gregory DeWitt Wiles, was a karate expert and a convicted felon who weighed a whopping 300 pounds. Now let's go back to that gorgeous little breakfast nook in that dirty little house where our 7 little vermin were gathered. A tall, bleak, 36-year-old, anorexic-looking man with curly hair, a sparse beard, and a retro porn stash pointed to the floor plan he had sketched. Here, this back bedroom, that's Dallas's room, he said. He keeps a sawed-off shotgun under the blanket. Here, this is Nash's room. There's a floor safe in the closet right over here. He tapped.
You sure about this, donkey dick?
Asked Tracy McCourt, the gang's wheelman. Hey, it's cool, said John Holmes, the man with the plan. I know, Eddie. Nash loves me. He thinks I'm famous. In his defense, he kind of was famous for one thing or another. Remember? His 11 to 15 inch meat stick, people. Keep up, you guys. Come on. Stay awake. So, the day of the heist, the Wonderland gang scraped together $400 or a little over $1,200 in today's money and drive the 1.6 miles, which is still 1.6 miles in today's miles, to Nash's house in Donna Lola in the stolen Ford Granada driven by the Wonderland gang that was running on empty gas fumes. In the car was Deverell, Lannis, McCourt, and a man named David Lind, a friend of Lannis's. Lind and his girlfriend had come down 3 weeks earlier from Sacramento to stay at Wonderland. Lind was an ex-convict who served time for burglary, forgery, and assault to commit rape. Man, these people really knew how to pick their friends, didn't they? Lind had been invited to town, apparently. He would later tell a court to practice his profession, aka committing crimes. Holmes goes into Nash's home under the pretense of buying drugs. It was now 8:30, Monday morning, June 29th, 1981. The Holmes had left Wonderland at midnight. He had stayed at Addie Nash's for 6 hours, smoking up the $400 he had taken to spend, helping himself to a little more of Nash's larger stash. Nash was extremely hospitable, and he always called Holmes my brother. They'd only known each other for 3 years, and that's why I tell y'all, you never really know someone. There's always a secret. As night stretched into morning, Holmes had an attack of conscience, a glimmer of an understanding that knocking over Eddie Nash might lead to a lot of trouble. Nash knew the Wonderland people. He'd never met them, but he had, through Holmes, given them a $1,000 loan, a little over $3,000 in today's money. Holmes had muttered something to Nash about the gang. He wasn't specific, but it didn't really matter anyway. Nash hadn't slept in the last 10 fucking days. He hardly knew what Holmes was saying, and as Holmes' supply of coke dwindled, his conscience was overruled by his Jones. He excused himself, left the room, and as planned, unlocked the sliding door. Arriving back at Wonderland just minutes after dawn, Holmes announced that the coast was clear. The time was right. There was this one small hitch, though. Deverell, Lanius, and McCourt, all heroin addicts, well, they were out cold. 3 hours later, everyone was finally awake. Holmes drove to Nash's again to make sure the sliding door was still open, and this time, the gang decided not to wait for his return. On June 29th, 1981, Lanius, Deverell, Lind, and McCourt committed a brutal home invasion and armed robbery at Eddie Nash's home, resulting in Nash's bodyguard, Gregory DeWitt Dials, being shot and injured. Wednesday afternoon, on July 1st, just 2 days after the robbery, Holmes had run into Dials, Nash's bodyguard, and this brilliant son of a bitch was wearing a ring that had been stolen from his boss, confirming Nash's suspicions that John Holmes had orchestrated the entire fucking thing. Good job there, Jenny. Fucking brilliant bastard. Gregory DeWitt Dials, 6'4", 300 pounds, barged through the front door of the house on Donna Lola, dragging John Holmes by the back of his neck. "In here," said Nash. Nash closed the door, and Dials smacked Holmes, threw him from across the room, shoved him against a wall. "How could you do this to me?" Eddie Nash asked him. Dials hit him again. "I trusted you. I gave you everything. And you were my friend." Nash and Holmes had met 3 years earlier at the Seven Seas. Nash, a sucker for romance, was a huge fan of porn. He even invested in these movies. Even leased office space in several porn-related operations. Holmes was one of the greats in the business, and Nash liked having him around. He introduced him to all of his guests. "I'd like you to meet my friend, Mr. John Holmes," he'd say. So proud. I guess I feel that. Betrayal from a friend, right? It's the worst. Doesn't matter if you've known them for 3 months or 3 years. Betrayal fucking hurts. Back to the story. For his part, Holmes did anything he could for Nash. Frequently, he brought him girls, and even on Christmas Day in 1980, he presented Jenna, his own mistress. Nash, he reciprocated with a quarter ounce of snow, a girl for blow. Wow, the bromance, you guys, my heart is just palpitating here. Holmes, though, thought Nash was the most evil man he'd ever met, but he couldn't quite figure him out. So, he just respected him. And now, things were not so friendly. Holmes was crumpled on the floor. Dials leveled a gun at his head. Nash was leafing through a little black book that Dials had taken from Holmes' pocket. "Who's in Ohio?" Nash asked. "I will kill your whole family. All of them. So, go back to that house. Get me my property. Bring me their eyeballs." You know what? Bring me their eyeballs in a bag, and I will forget what you've done to me. Go. So, John left. But who murdered whom?